Well, thank you. I need to give you a little disclaimer right up front here. I'm by nature and background a clinician. I spent nearly a quarter century in the clinical practice of geriatric neuropsychology. It was only 3 years ago that I began teaching at Dort, and Dort is in Northwest Iowa. So I've had to shift gears quite a bit. But between the two experiences, I've acquired quite an appreciation for not only Alzheimer's disease itself, but also some other perspectives that load into the whole issue of Alzheimer's disease. The one that I want to particularly highlight today is our perspective of the soul, whether we look at the soul from a monistic perspective or a dualistic perspective. I'm going to go out on a limb right now. Please don't move, don't throw anything. I'm probably one of the only dualists in the room. However, I want to encourage you to listen and to pay attention to what I have to say here, because not all dualism is strict, radical Cartesian dualism. What I want to cover today includes several points having to do with the soul itself. I want to look a little bit at the pathophysiology, I should say the presentation of Alzheimer's disease. I want to look at that from a monistic perspective, and then also from a what the implications of that are. And then I want to then shift over and look at it from a perspective known as the holistic dualism view. So let's start by just kind of looking at some general characteristics or commonly held perspectives or characteristics of the soul that we as Christians in the sciences typically hold. The soul consists of things like conscious awareness, self-identity, the capacity to think, self-determination and volition. There's certainly a capacity probably a need is a better term for it, for meaningful relationship, not only with God, but also with others. Dallas Willard, back in the late 90s, characterized the soul as an essential aspect of human personhood and life. He said that the soul is an aspect of oneself that maintains the capacity to integrate all aspects of life into a single whole. Kind of sounds like monism. But he wasn't a monist. Brown and Straw. And this is drawn out of their 2012 text. Refer to, well, not the soul per se, but from their monistic perspective, they call it the soulishness, as it were. And they characterize that as including things like rationality, relationality, morality, and religiousness. Again, part of this whole picture. I want you to keep these in mind. I want you to try and overlay these with what we draw from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. It's in its fifth edition. This is what I use as a clinician. These are the six major cognitive domains that are routinely evaluated when we're looking at neurocognitive disorders. We used to call these dementias, but technically the term that we use now is neurocognitive disorder. Many people still use dementia, and that's fine. Notice that learning and memory is one of these domains. Complex attention, executive function, think back to volition, think back to rationality. Language, okay, ability to relate to other people through language, receptive and expressive. Perceptual motor ability, and even social cognition, which is an important aspect of a monistic perspective of the soul as well. When we start looking at Alzheimer's disease and its progression, we see a fairly consistent progression over time. And it's about at the point where a person is really losing their ability to meaningfully interact and relate to others that we start viewing this progression as reaching more of a severely impaired range, okay? I want you to think about that as we look here for just a few moments at the monistic perspective of the soul. I'm actually going to just cite two different sources here. One is Brown and Strawn's text again. And they actually refer to Alzheimer's in that text. I'm just going to quote this. Because of a loss of rational capacity and severe cognitive disability, quote, persons with Alzheimer's disease cannot offer an equal contribution to interpersonal relationships, which are a core aspect of personhood. Therefore, others will need to contribute more to sustaining and fostering relatedness. According to Brown and Strawn, that meaningful relatedness is something that develops after birth, and it is something then that becomes an issue when we look at Alzheimer's, especially as the disease progresses. My question is, what happens then when meaningful interaction becomes impossible for that individual, where, as they would say, soulishness has been extinguished? A second perspective, Joel Green, more of a theologically oriented perspective. He writes a lot about this in his 2008 book. And he didn't specifically address Alzheimer's disease, but let me see if I can draw out a few ideas here. One, and I'll just quote again, he says that the phenomenological experiences that we label soul are neither reducible to brain activity nor evidence of a substantial ontological entity such as a soul, but rather represent essential aspects or capacity of the self. Okay. Well, one of my first questions, of course, is, well, what is the self? What does that mean? Well, I believe he's referring to personhood. And when he refers to personhood, he defines that as our genetically enabled embodied capacity for ongoing formation as storied relational beings. So again, this sense of personhood is a sense of self, and it has to do with our ability to relate meaningfully to others. Obviously, in advanced stages of Alzheimer's, that sense of relatedness gets lost. Sense of self-identity gets lost. I have a quote down here. Does anybody know who Augusta D is? Augusta D was Dr. Alois Alzheimer's first patient, the patient with whom he identified the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease a little over 100 years ago. On one such occasion, he was sitting with her, handed her a pen and a piece of paper and said, please write your name for me. She looked at the paper, looked up at him, set the pen down and said, I have lost myself. I've lost myself. I suspect that Green might say, well, she was still able to meaningfully interact, although that didn't last too much longer either. She had an early onset case and passed away in her early 50s. Now, the biggest concern that I have with the monistic perspective and Alzheimer's disease is this. What we're really talking about here is a loss of personhood prior to death. It's the result then of an advanced Alzheimer's-related brain deterioration. Personhood then, as I'm going to call it, or the soul, if you will, would be extinguished, apparently, prior to death. My next question then is, what do we do with this individual who has reached this advanced stage of Alzheimer's? Now, we as Christians would say, well, you know, take care of them and so forth and so forth. But what are we taking care of? Okay. We have to think about that. Okay. I worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of people with Alzheimer's disease over the course of my career. And when you're staring into eyes that are glazed over, you know that the person is struggling to meaningfully relate to you. But does that mean that that person is no longer there? Well,
I don't know.
That's why we're talking here today. When we talk about the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, there are several, or I should say there are a few things that we can do, some of which are more helpful than others. One is we can administer cognitive medications, acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, things of that nature, Aricept, Razadyne, Exelon, products like that. But these are rather expensive products, and the jury is still rather hung with regard to whether or not there is any value in these medications. Moreover, they're still rather expensive. So, at the point where this person no longer can meaningfully relate, do we decide that the cost and the efficacy just isn't there, so we remove the medication? Research has recently shown, and this was already informally evaluated shortly after Aricept first came on the market, and the manufacturer really didn't know how to answer this question for geriatricians. But research has shown that if you remove the medication at the point where it seems not to work anymore, that person's functional ability trails off precipitously. If you resume the medication, they'll level out, but they'll level out down here. Okay, they don't go back up again. So you're compromising quality of life if you discontinue the medication. Nevertheless, we have to at least take a look at this from a monistic perspective. How do we justify this? How does this work together? Okay. Number two, do we discontinue attention to physical, interpersonal, and spiritual needs? Ade was the fellow who kind of inspired me to develop this presentation. He, in the December edition of the Perspectives Journal, talked about spiritual needs and so forth, and challenged us to take a look at those. Spiritual needs, physical needs, interpersonal needs, at the point where a person can no longer meaningfully relate. All right, so yes, one would think then that we probably should do these things. And as Christians, yeah, we would probably agree with that. Nevertheless, it starts conflicting with our perspective, our monistic perspective again. What's, in a sense, the point? Okay. Tell me, I'm going out on a limb here. But just hang in there with me. Humor me. The third one, probably the most controversial. What about physician-assisted suicide? How, in a monistic perspective, is that not a viable option? Christian or non-Christian? Okay. Now, one would think that as Christians we would, as it were, know better. But for what reason? Based upon what, if you maintain a monistic perspective? Food for thought. It's a rather slippery slope. Moreland and Ray, in their 2000 text on the soul, really raised great concern about the moral and ethical crises that we're facing as a result of our emerging or developing monistic perspectives. And I think they have a point. So, let me shift gears. Some central points we need to keep in mind. When we talk about monism or dualism of the soul, I think we need to all agree that, number one, God's created order is revealed through Scripture. Special revelation, right? And also through nature, through God's general revelation. Okay. Number two, Scripture is neither clearly monistic nor dualistic. Green, a gentleman I'll talk about in a moment, named John Cooper, and pretty much anybody who has written in this particular area, has acknowledged that from a theological perspective, Scripture is neither monistic nor dualistic. It just isn't there. And there were speakers earlier today who talked about this in other terms. There are times when it's not easy to integrate scriptural truth or scriptural elements with our scientific pursuits. Number three, all forms of monism are not equal. So there may be forms of monism that may be much more amenable, as it were, to maintaining ethical and moral treatment of Alzheimer's, but then there are probably a few others that are not going to be able to do that. Let's recognize, however, on the flip side, that there are many different forms of dualism as well. Okay, let me just give you one. John Cooper wrote about this already back in 1989. He came out with the second edition of his book in 2000. He was he's retired now out of Calvin Theological Seminary. He talked about a body-soul interaction that occurs at a subatomic level. And what he's referring to here is not a radical Cartesian dualism. Matter of fact, he acknowledges that narrativity and relationality are important, and that this is actually a perspective that is compatible with a dual constituent monism. He writes, suppose there is pervasive interaction at the subatomic level of the brain. The hundreds of thousands of thoughts, memories, beliefs, feelings, moods, commitments, hopes, and loves which humans have will all correlate and interact with millions of patterned events in the brain, thereby interfacing with the numerous subsystems which network the various regions of the brain. The regional subsystems in turn monitor and regulate bodily functions and are likewise influenced by what goes on in the rest of the organism. I won't go on, but he's talking about a highly sophisticated dualistic model, not a strict extreme Cartesianism. He actually says it's compatible with a dual constituent monism, which, interestingly enough, Malcolm Jeeves and Thomas Ludwig just released a new book. I had the privilege of doing a quick read of this over the past month, an advanced copy, and they indicate in there in this new book. They say, we must recognize the mysterious duality of our mental life and our physical body while accepting our essential psychobiological unity as whole complete persons. Because both aspects of the human person are important and relevant, we use the rather clumsy label dual aspect monism to characterize our view. So they're actually referring to something very similar to what Cooper has already talked about. The difference is whether or not we can somehow accept an intermediate state. Scripture talks about the intermediate state, Rephaim, dwelling in Sheol. Okay? Think about Saul and the Witch of Endor, the story in 1 Samuel. By the way, that story was written about 300 years before Plato was born. Okay? Think about Isaiah 26, Rephaim dwelling in Sheol. He talks about that as well. That was about 150 years before Plato was born. And we start attributing a lot of our dualistic perspectives to Plato and to Descartes, but this predates that. Cooper did a great exegesis not only of the Old and New Testaments, but also the intertestamental period, and said the same thing was there. The development of an intermediate state eschatology was there. We see it in the New Testament as well. This was a view that was held by the Pharisees, including Paul, who happened to be a Pharisee. Okay? He was a Pharisee, trained under Gamaliel. This was a view held by Christ, apparently. Why would he use the parable of Lazarus and the rich man were it not for some kind of an underlying understanding of an intermediate state? From my perspective, a holistic dualism, which is what Cooper calls this, is the most adequately it more adequately justifies continued moral and ethical treatment of people with Alzheimer's, going back around, full circle. You know, we attend to their needs until the natural end of their life. Moreover, it more sufficiently accounts for the traditional Christian thought on the destiny of the soul at death, a disembodied soul. This model is so closely related to a dual aspect monism that I think we need to take another look at this. We need to start looking at what we should do or how we might continue our research along these lines. Okay? Maybe we're going to have to look at things like volition, intent, initiation, and cognitive processing and behavior. Maybe this is going to be at a subatomic level. We probably don't even have the technology to do this yet, but I think it's important enough that we need to strive to consider that we may have something happening at a subatomic level, as Cooper articulates it. Okay. We need to, in conclusion, recognize that we may not always be able to establish incontrovertible scientific proof of scriptural and theological constructs. Okay. We're going to have limitations. We're going to have to maintain dialogue as well with the theological and philosophical communities. And through this process, we must remember what faith really is. Through that process of remembering and of struggling with our faith, it can help strengthen our relationship with and our dependence upon our Creator God. That was the wrong button. There we go. So I'm finished.
We have 10 minutes for questions, and I'm sure that there will be a few.
10? I thought we had 5.
Yes. Sir, could you help someone who doesn't understand the difference, the clear difference between monism and dualism? Give me a brief rundown of the difference.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can give you my understanding of the monistic perspective. The dualistic perspective is the one that I hold is Cooper's, which I just really kind of described to you, where you have it's a holistic perspective of the individual, which is scriptural, but we also need to acknowledge and understand and accept the potential for the soul to exist apart from the body, the disembodied soul. Okay. A monistic perspective does not utilize that. In a monistic perspective, generally, the physiologic function of the brain itself is contributing to or is causing the development of these soul-like properties or qualities. It's more of a qualitative descriptor. And I believe we may have somebody here who's done the writing on that particular matter. Dr. Warren, she's more than welcome to clarify my perspective on that, on monism.
So different types of monism, yes. Often it's equated with materialism. So saying like brain and mind are the same thing, that's the simplest way. But there's also a Buddhist form where everything's consciousness. So different types of monism. The commonest is that it's all materialistic. And then the extreme Cartesian dualism is that they're completely separate. Very few people hold either of those extreme positions among Christians. So there's all these various ways that the dual aspect monism or the interactional forms of interactional dualism.
Yes.
It's so simple.
I might also mention that Francis Collins was interviewed by John Cooper in 2008. And as Cooper has conveyed it to me, Collins believes that God created and infused the human soul into hominids. So he's a dualist. But that doesn't mean a radical Cartesian dualism. Yes.
If someone's relationship with another person can be severed if they have Alzheimer's, for example, could someone with Alzheimer's kind of lose their relationship with God? That they kind of forget who God is or lose their faith?
Well, in my understanding of monism, that theoretically could happen. Now, again, there are different forms of monism, and you have different perspectives on that. And my intent today is to encourage you to take a look at the various forms of monism and the various forms of dualism in order to make a well-informed decision.
In your clinical experience,
yeah,
have you had any experiences that would suggest to you that there is a mind that extends beyond the brain?
No. Not at that point of, you know, in the progression.
Yeah.
When you've reached this severe point. And I can speak professionally and I can speak academically on this, but I can also speak personally.
Yeah.
We have early onset Alzheimer's in my mother's family, and my mother and my uncle both developed it at age 62, so I personally experienced that progression as well. And I, for her though, she maintained at least a modicum of relatedness up until the end. There are some that don't reach that point though. But I've not seen that. That's where I think we need to consider future research possibilities.
Wait in the corner.
I think this is really interesting. I'm wondering if you could reflect. I was struck by the quote from Brownie Strawn, which she then argued against. If there's some sense of community compensation, that rather than this kind of extreme Western view of soulishness or souls being in the person, but that they're between people as well. And so if you have somebody with diminished capacities, as is the case with Alzheimer's, right, when the community, the body of believers that we were designed to be a part of, cares for that person, their dignity is maintained.
It's a capacity for relationality on the part of the individual, and if that becomes lost, there's a disconnect, as I understand it, that would occur under that perspective. Because according to Brown and Strawn, and correct me if I'm wrong here, according to Brown and Strawn, it's that that sense of relatedness that really is a soulish quality that we maintain, we develop, and we maintain through our lifetime. Hey, folks, we haven't even thought about prenatal development. What the soul develops after the person begins developing relational ability after they're born. I don't want to go there, but basically what we're looking at, from my understanding of it, is that's essentially what's happening.
My spouse, my dear spouse, was diagnosed with not really onset, but just early symptoms of Alzheimer's in the fall. And I can tell you all that he was certainly losing his soul. No question about it.
In what way?
Just his essence was just dribbling away. The doctor prescribed Aricept, and after a couple of months, a whole lot of his way of being, his soul came back, I guess is the point I'm trying to make.
Well, and I'm very sorry that your husband is going through this, and I totally understand. But if I may, for just a moment, is it possible that his ability to meaningfully express his soul was what was being suppressed?
Absolutely.
And that the soul may have actually been existing, may exist still, somewhere at a different level. In other words, you have this intimate interaction between potentially the soul and these functions. And so is the soul a direct product then of the brain activity itself, or is the brain activity that we're seeing on MRIs and so forth actually a manifestation of the soul's initiation, as it were, of
his soul was in hiding.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is the way I think of it.
Yeah.
It was in hiding because of a lack of whatever communication it was among neurons for it to get back out.
Yeah.
The Aricept has made
it possible.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's we have access to his soul again.
One more short question.
This is kind of fundamental to your talk. I'm a clinician as well in an emergency room, so I deal with folk with this condition pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I failed to understand how a monistic versus a dualistic view of personhood informs treatment decisions. It seems to me that no matter which, it kind of seems like an academic discussion to me. But at the end of the day, you are trying to treat people with dignity and suffering and so on.
Yes.
Regardless.
But take a look at the broader trend in society today. Okay. A broader trend is to say, well, there's a certain point at which it's just not worth it for these people, for a person to live anymore under any condition. Could be, severe traumatic brain injury, whatever. So at that point, what do we do? Okay. And as Christians, yes, you're right. We look at things from that perspective. My challenge or my encouragement is to consider that maintaining that type of perspective
can sometimes lead to a slippery slope. And you start eventually making decisions that isn't really that well connected with your theological heritage, as it were, or your theological perspective. One would hope it would not happen, but that's my concern.
Okay. We need to move on. I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion later.